Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. On this week's show, Checker Finn, the President Emeritus of Fordham Institute and the original Education Gadfly, joins us to discuss the best and worst developments in education reform in 2023. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber covers the best education research of the year. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
On behalf of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, I give this study an A++++.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Flapping back in, glad to be here.
Yes, Checker, our President Emeritus, Distinguished Senior Fellow, Original Education Gadfly, Hoover Institution Fellow. What else can we say about you? Grand Poobah.
Sure, and lots of formerlies.
All right. Well, many of which with great distinction. Also joining us, as always, not as many formerlies, but a great career ahead, David Griffith.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to see you as well.
It is great to have you back on, David. So we were just chatting. We are taping this on a day when we just had the Fordham holiday party the night before. We encourage people to bring their families. The Fordham baby boom is for real. There were babies. There were toddlers. There was complete chaos.
Brood X, I think we should call them.
You're right. A lot like the cicadas. Yes. About as noisy but a lot of fun. Super, super fun.
Wait till they're 17 years old. Whoa.
Yes. Well, my 16-year-old was there. We had 3 13-year-olds. So there was a pack on the teenage side as well. Next year, I think we're going to take all the teenagers and all the little toddlers and babies and put them in one room and then the adults in another. And we're going to go that way. All right. Well, it is that time of year, not just for holiday parties, but also for looking back on the year that was. We are going to do a bit of a 2023 roundup on education reform update. All right, Checker. I don't think we did this with you last year. I think we had Mark Porter McGee on a year ago, but we are excited to have you back in this role so we can talk about all the great things that happened in 2023. Best and worst. Now, here's the challenge. Can you think of anything good that happened in 2023? Not just because it was in some ways still another challenging year, but because, you tend to be a glass is half empty kind of guy.
Yeah, two good things happened. One of them is sort of an ongoing story, which is continuing progress of school choice on multiple fronts around the country. And we've been saying that for a couple of years now, and it's been true, though some of the more esoteric forms of school choice may eventually turn into things that aren't so good. I'm not completely sanguine about it, but it is definitely an ongoing form of education reform that a lot of which happened in 2023.
And you're referring to education savings accounts in particular that you're not sure whether to be excited about or not.
I'm iffy, lukewarm, kind of worried, kind of hopeful, kind of worried. Both, yes, half full, half empty. Same time right now. The other sort of good news, and we've talked about this a lot at Fordham sessions lately, has been the march forward of the science of reading, and people in a lot more places paying a lot more attention to how to teach little kids to read in ways that actually work. And I think that's a good thing. It's a little piece of the sort of curriculum stuff that we didn't do enough of over the last 20 years. This is probably the best area in which to concentrate because it's the one we know the most about.
Okay, there we go. That does sound positive. Though I guess I would say at this point, we feel like there's a lot of legislative action, maybe State Department of Ed action. We hope it's translating into real changes in the classroom, right? Enthusiasm, but we're not 100% sure about that yet.
But that's true of every reform in history. They start at a level of government and they may or may not trickle down into the classroom experience of actual children.
Right. The loosely coupled train. Okay, David, what about you? Are you feeling any more positive today than Checker is?
I am not feeling any more positive than Checker is. I think mine would be the same. And I can only echo what Checker said, which is, I think, you know, sometimes folks criticize performers for not getting into the classroom. And I always tend to push back on that a little bit. I'm a tight, loose kind of guy. But there's an exception to every rule. And I think, you know, not just performers, but kind of education types broadly have managed to put aside their differences and focus on something that, you know, we can all agree on. And that's the science of reading and the importance of reading, right? And I guess I'd add to that kind of, you know, it seems like we are seeing some action around grade retention. And I don't really want to spin that as like a positive in the sense that we don't want to hold kids back, right? If we don't, you know, if we don't have to. But it does seem to me that there is a nascent movement to try to hold the line a little bit more in terms of, you know, just letting kids move on without putting up much of a fuss, right? To the extent that we can require them to attend, you know, summer school, implement, you know, real reforms and sort of tutoring that just gets after the reading thing. Basically, just, you know, get serious, right? And not just allow this new post-pandemic norm that nobody actually knows how to read to become a norm. I think the fact that I see people fighting back against that and looking for ways to stem the tide is a positive.
Okay, there we go. I would add one thing, which is the Houston takeover. You know, I'm excited about Mike Miles and team going in there and really trying to make changes. It's the fourth or fifth largest school district in the country. And it does harken back to an earlier time when we saw states more willing to do something about chronic low performance at the district level. So way to go, Mike Miles, as well as to the Texas Education Agency. All right. Now, the worst. I do fear that we have a larger body of things to choose from here because, look, we're still going backwards, right? We say this every year. This is going to be the year that we're finally going to start turning things around after the pandemic. So far, not yet. Checker, what's on your mind?
Well, of course, there's real world bad news, and then there's policy world bad news. In the real world, there is a continuing failure to catch kids back up to where they ought to be, much less where they ought to be. And in the real world, there's also an epidemic of absenteeism going on that we don't seem to know what to do about. And I guess you could say there's an epidemic of mental health issues going on that we don't seem to know what to do about. In the policy world, there's continuing backsliding on most of educational accountability. You gave the exception in Houston, which is a lovely counterexample at a particular city. But if you look across the state of results-based accountability in education broadly, it's a lot more negative than positive this past year on multiple examples. And finally, the way the culture wars have slid into more and more aspects of K-12 and leading to a greater politicization in some places. The, you know, the Moms for Liberty thing started as a kind of a way to get icky books out of libraries, but now it seems to also be part of a partisan crusade rather than just an educational anxiety. So I don't like that one either.
Okay, there we go. David, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going to try to lump everything together under the sort of umbrella of student engagement. It's Checker touched on this, but I think we just had a pro-screen cultural shock in the pandemic that we are still just beginning to wrestle with, right? I mean, I am heartened to see districts and schools starting to take kids' phones away, but it's, you know, it's a handful of districts and it ought to be thousands. I am sort of at a loss, like Checker, about exactly what to do about the attendance crisis, but I think these things are linked, right? I mean, we need to get kids off of their screens, talking to one another, talking to their teachers. I mean, it sounds like I'm not even talking about education here, right? But you can't educate kids who can't engage in basic human interactions, right? Who are lonely and have no point of reference that, you know, it within their sort of
a semi-adult life, right? Look, come on. Some of us remember what it was like before the pandemic. And every single responsible adult needs to be taking away their kid's phone, okay, or not giving it to them, and telling their parent friends to do the same thing, and insisting that their principals do the same thing, and telling their parents to get their kids to school. And it's just, it's a very profound cultural shift that we have to unwind. And I do see some signs of progress, but it's just, it's taking too long. And we're only beginning to come to grips with it.
I love it, David, the passion. And yes, and look, you know, I agree with you that this is a huge thing. Certainly, I think if you look across what we've covered on the podcast all these months, we've talked a lot about phones. We've talked a lot about chronic absenteeism. We've talked about grades and grade inflation, which is another thing in this stew. Yeah, I mean, we need it. Look, it's the classic notion. I remember, you know, Checker having a poster on his wall saying everyone needs standards, right? It's getting back to this basic notion of upholding standards again, and their basic standards, get to school, you know, every day.
The stupidity of some of the excuses is just mind blowing, right? Like, oh, we can't take away their phones, right? Because, you know, if there's an emergency, we need to call them. Are you telling me honestly that Apple or whoever can't come up with a device that allows you to call your kids in an emergency that doesn't have access to TikTok and the internet? Like, is that beyond our technological capability? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. And what's nuts is every single functional adult that I know feels exactly the same way about this. And yet nothing seems to be happening. So anyway, that's to me, I don't know. You said, what's the worst? That's the worst, right? It's so much bigger than anything else. And I'm all for reform, but some things are bigger than reform. And we are struggling in this basic mental health, student engagement level that we can't talk about enough.
Checker, I think David is out gadflying you right now. Any last words?
Everyone needs standards, but in the old days, that referred to academic standards. Now we're talking about standards of behavior, standards of participation, standards of, you could say, engagement, standards of classroom behavior. I mean, there are whole list of domains now in which our standards are slipping. It's not just reading and math.
Yep. No, that's right. But let me finish with, of course, my perennial note of optimism. If there's any positive thing, at least when it comes to high schools, I do wonder if this is going to push us to ask bigger questions about how do we make it a better use of teenagers' time to come to high school, right? To show up every day. And if it's, they don't actually have to be there every day, some kids that we maybe see some experimentation around a hybrid model around, you know, some days at home, some days at school, you know, it's the same conversation as with getting people back to the office. You got to make sure that those days in the office actually are well used and that there's collaboration and that they see other human beings. And so I think that a huge part of this is as you're saying, we need to get back to just some basic standards. Another piece of this is, look, there's some opportunity for reform here, maybe, because we do waste kids' time a lot. And yes, I'm speaking from personal experience with my N of two, but you know, can I say that every day, my sons get something out of showing up at school? Far from it, right? And we could do some positive work on that front as well. Yes, David?
Yes, Mike. But Mike, they do. That's the thing, right? Even if they just go and they chatter with their friends, they do get something out of school that they don't get from sitting at home and being on, you know, TikTok or social media or whatever. I mean, it seems useless, but even the most useless moment, it could be worse, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And we've come dangerously close to making it worse.
All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for now. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Checker, and flying in here as you do occasionally. Happy holidays to you and yours.
Thank you very much. And a happy new year to all, and to all a good night.
Yes. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So we had such a fun holiday party with the Fordham National Gang last week. Woo! But man, was it loud.
What did you notice that too, Mike?
I don't know if David noticed it. It was loud, not because we were like some crazy party animals, but because we invited everybody's families, and we have had a Fordham baby boom. There were babies, there were toddlers, there were 4 year olds.
It was teenagers.
It was complete mayhem.
There were so many breakable things too, Mike.
Oh my gosh. And your son, I think we clocked him doing at least 100 laps of the room that we were in.
That's right. He passed every wine glass like 150 times.
The highlight of my evening, Mike, was David's daughter, Rory, finally shared her crayons with me as she was.
Hey, you made fast work. You won her over in like a matter of minutes on it, it seemed like.
I sat in her chair once, I think, when she was up somewhere else, and she looked very mad at me when she came back.
Yeah, I told her about you.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
It was super sweet. I don't know. You know, it did bring me back to those days of little kids running around. Whew, gave me some PTSD. All right, Amber. Well, it is that time of year. We're at the end of the year. And so not only does that mean holiday parties, that means the Research Minute Year in Review.
Yes, the top 5 RMs of 2023. I was saying before we started broadcasting here that we'll see if you guys agree with me. It's hard to go through all of these studies. But anyway, I think I got my top 5. We'll see what you think.
Top 5 studies of the year. Okay, let's hear them.
Number 5, we're going to go down. This is a recent one, so hopefully you'll remember this one. It's probably because they scooped us. This is a grade inflation study that Dan Goldhaber and his co-author looked at. They were trying to see if grade inflation before and after COVID had, you know, whether it had bounced back to what it looked like before COVID, whether it had been permanently lowered in terms of what we're seeing with grade inflation. They looked in Washington, basically found that, you know, Washington, like most states, had kind of given districts the adoption of pass or no credit, incomplete, you know, all kinds of policy changes. And then districts, when they finally were allowed to assign grades again, some of them did, some of them didn't. So not surprising, they find that in alignment with the state guidance, almost no kids received an F in the spring of 2020. The share of Fs dropped from roughly 9% to 1% or less in almost every subject area. The share of A's jumped from 33 to 56% in math, 36 to 60% in English, 33 to 59% in science. Bottom line was, good news is that the English and science grades largely returned to pre-pandemic levels by 21-22, but the math grades did not. So we were kind of wondering about that on the podcast here recently, and particularly concerning that Algebra 1 is a gateway class, and you don't want to have misalignment between the signals there with what parents know and what if the kids are going to be ready for advanced math.
That's right. And especially we think the test scores in math really dropped a lot and the grades did not.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
On behalf of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, I give this study an A++++.
Okay.
Oh, well, you're part of the problem, David.
We'll keep going. Yes. All right. Number 4, Calder paper, 13 scholars examined academic mobility in U.S. public schools. They're trying to figure out whether all kids are academically mobile. And by that, they mean, are their ranks and the distribution of their, you know, of academic performance, do they change at all during their K-12, education? They were looking at 3 million kids in 7 states. Big finding, overall students' ranks and the distribution of academic performance are highly persistent. We've heard this before during their K-12 education career. For example, on average, a student who starts at the 25th percentile in the third grade can be expected to perform at roughly the 30th percentile by high school. Among students who begin with a low performance rank, those from more advantaged backgrounds generally have greater upward academic mobility than their peers from less advantaged backgrounds. The one thing that I liked about this study, though, I mean, because I know that's pretty sobering, is that they said, you know what, there's one promising implication, because baseline mobility is a key driver of district differences. So districts that have high baseline mobility increase progress throughout that academic distribution. And so low performing, you know, students tend to experience their largest gains in the districts where kids generally excel overall. And so they're basically saying, you know what, if we can build a culture of excellence in schools as early as, you know, K, pre-K, across the board, aimed at all students, then that could be the rising tide that lifts all boats. You remember that study?
I do.
Yes.
I also remember that, wow, 15 people involved in it. That's
I think it was 13. Sorry, 13.
Okay.
Yes. But anyway, it was a big initiative there.
Yeah.
Okay. That was number four. We ready for number three?
Yes.
All right. Number three, another summer study. I think this was August too. Yeah. An NBER and Mathematica descriptive report examined disenrollment patterns from public schools and whether this disenrollment had bounced back, and if so, among whom and from which sectors. They start off by providing these national estimates, specifically that in the first year of COVID, 1.5 million K-12 kids left the public school system for alternatives like homeschooling and private school. And then they looked at these other national studies and they said, you know what, it doesn't look like public enrollment recovered in 21-22, and it remains still about 3% below pre-pandemic enrollment levels. And then they did a deep dive into Michigan to look at these patterns more closely and to give us a little bit more, discrete data. In Michigan, they find that 55% of those who exited before fall 2020 re-enrolled in the public system by fall 2021. The re-enrollment rate was highest at kindergarten. 62% of kids who left public school and didn't enroll in first grade by fall of 2020 had re-enrolled in fall 2021. They looked at the return rates for other middle and elementary school grades. They were slightly lower than kindergarten at 56%, and the return rate was lowest among high school kids, with just 40% of those kids returning. Then they look at the sectors. They find the higher return rates among those who left for homeschooling compared to those who left for private schools. Specifically, 50% of kids who exited for homeschooling by fall of 2020 returned to the public sector by fall 2021, but only 20% of those who exited for public schools returned. Then they looked at race and they said, compared to white kids, Black kids were more likely to return and Asian students were less likely to return.
I don't know about this one, Amber. Really? This deserves the top five?
I mean, come on. We didn't know these numbers. We didn't have sector numbers. We didn't have race numbers.
All right. I'm just saying. I'm just, you know, it's a high bar here, but it gives us hope that descriptive studies can get some love. Okay.
Really, that was an NBR study, Mike. I mean, and Mathematica, that was big money on that study.
All right. I mean, to me, I'm like, of course, a lot of kids came back. I mean, we knew that was going to happen.
Yeah. But did you know like the homeschooling and the private schooling numbers?
I could have guessed that. Let me think. Let's see. I'm trying to homeschool my kids. No, that's not going to last over the long term.
Number two, this is Adam in February. Like, I'm on vacation and I, as diligent as I am, I decide, sure, I'll listen to the episodes when I'm not away. And Adam covered a study in February when I was out. It was a David Figlio and Umit Ozek NBER study. They're looking at the unintended consequences of test-based remediation. Maybe you'll remember this from Adam. The study looked at middle school remediation in Florida. Policymakers required students who were below proficient in a subject to be placed in a remedial class in that subject, where they received smaller class sizes, more effective teachers, among some other things. So, for instance, if you failed your fifth grade reading test, you were to take a remedial class in ELA in sixth grade. They had a regression discontinuity design. They found that in the short term, students placed in remedial classes were less likely to take advanced courses in other subjects. And this was even more common for kids of color. That was obviously a negative effect, but what they found was that the negative effects for all students started to diminish over subsequent years. And by high school, the effect of middle school remediation was zero or positive for all subgroups. And in particular, the positive effects were for the Hispanic kids, who are more likely to take more college-bearing courses in high school. So researchers end up saying that, you know, these positive results likely occurred as a result of putting kids in the one subject in which they actually needed remediation versus putting them in remediation for all subjects, which was not the intent of the policy.
And you had to actually stick with it and follow the kids long enough to see the positive impact.
That is right, which we don't always do, and don't studies often don't get funded to do that either. So
right. Now that sounds like a study that is worthy of the top five.
David's just nodding his head. David, you got thumbs up or thumbs down on that one?
I'm thumbs up on all good studies, Amber.
All right. We're going to have a debate, I bet, on number one, but I'm really liking number one. Number one was February. So think back. Whew. This is my drum roll. How well, this was a study by John Pompey and Dick Murnane. They're looking at how well do our public high schools prepare students for future success? I mean, hello, that is a pretty big question that we need answering. So their key finding was that similar students who attend schools at the 80th percentile of the value-added distribution, so these schools are the high value-added schools that are good at boosting student achievement, they're 6 percentage points more likely to graduate from a four-year college and earn 13% or $3,600 more annually at age 30 compared to peers who attend schools performing at the 20th percentile. What's more, the schools that improve outcomes the most are not simply those that serve relatively few low-income kids, as they also found a bunch of schools that serve lots of those kids have significant positive impacts on their later life outcomes as well. And basically, I mean, this is good news. We're basically saying, okay, high schools can make a meaningful difference and they can improve those that improve test scores and college aspirations more than we'd expect. Also improve longer term outcomes more than we'd expect.
Here, here, here. I agree 100% with this one, Amber. This was, I agree, the most important study of the year. And to find it in high schools too, right? Because a lot of us, I'll speak for myself. I mean, I feel like there's some evidence that it's hard to bend the curve at the high school level. It's late, you know, and to show that it still matters, that these, that high school is not too late, that if you can make rapid growth, even in these basic skills, reading and math in high school, it makes a difference in real world outcomes for kids.
It does.
I love it. And I do hope somebody's out there trying to see if the same thing can be said for middle schools and for elementary schools, where probably some of the impact fades, but then again, they have a chance to intervene earlier. Maybe it's a big impact there too.
Mike, that feels kind of like a study we proposed that didn't get funded. Am I wrong about that?
I know. Funders. Well, maybe we should try again.
Well, nice to know you agree on my number one.
I do. Oh, you know, I had to just give you a little bit of a hard time.
I know you're not. Sometimes you throw a little shade at those descriptive studies, but hey.
Well, no, that is great, man. As we say often, that is that the education research enterprise has come a long, long way since Fordham started doing our work more than a quarter century ago. Amazing that it is not very often that you struggle to find a good study week in and week out. And so way to go, researchers and funders and academics. Good things happening out there.
Yes, indeed. I actually had, you know, was two more. I could have added to the list, but I said, nope, I'm going to just stick to five like I try to do.
All right. Well, very good. All right. Well, hey, I think that is all the time we have, unfortunately, but I hope you both have wonderful holidays and a great time off with friends and family.
You too, Mike. And to all of our listeners, the same.
Absolutely. All right. Then until 2024.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.